supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. April 15th marks Holocaust Remembrance Day, and on today's show, we'll take a different kind of look at the Holocaust. We'll talk with a survivor who was hidden by a family and a professor who studies love and altruism. So what does love and altruism have to do with the Holocaust? Well, sociologist Dr. Arthur Shostak has traveled all over the world to memorials and museums, and he says we should pay more attention to the incredible stories of humanity and compassion that took place inside those camps and what those stories can teach us about resilience and maybe even what it means to be human. Shostak spoke with our producer, Mike and Scott.
In 2005 and 2006, you traveled to Europe with your wife to visit several concentration camps. Tell me about that trip.
The trip was very deliberate. We were curious to learn what now, over 60 years from the end of the war, what now was available in educational materials. We also wanted to understand what the guides were saying. So we listened carefully to the guides. We listened and watched and read every bit of display material, picked up all the leaflets and pamphlets, and then we asked ourselves, what is it that people were learning? And that's where our disagreement began.
What do you think was missing?
What seemed to be missing was the recognition that when people are in groups, I learned this years ago as a sociologist, when people are in groups, they reach out to one another. We are wired in our brains and in our instincts for mutual survival. We are not Darwinian tooth and claw. We are not one against the other. We are instead, maybe you can help me. Maybe I can help you. Maybe together we can make things just a bit better. And none of that got attention, either from the guides in the five camps we visited, or from the wall material, or from the pamphlets and leaflets. So we left puzzled by this. And what we've come up with is the notion that there's an imbalance, a serious imbalance, that the horror is of such magnitude, the crimes were so scientific, that that's what makes the display material. That's what the guide dwells on. That's what people expect to hear when they arrive. And the other part of the story, the notion that victims might, some unknown number of them, might say, I am not going to be reduced to a cipher. I am not going to play the part in the script the Nazis write for me. I am going to be more than that. I'm going to stay in touch with my soul, my religion, my politics, despite every bad thing that happens and my inability to keep bad from happening to people who my heart goes out to. I'm still going to be a person. And it wasn't enough attention paid to any of that.
I wonder, though, if the pressure to keep the history of the Holocaust alive and in the forefront of our minds, I wonder if that pressure has created the focus on the atrocities, because in this world today, there are still people who deny that the Holocaust has happened. There are people who would like to forget about the Holocaust. So I'm wondering if people are afraid that if they start talking about the good in people too much, that maybe then we will forget about the terrible things that have happened.
I respect those concerns. And what I'm asking is not that we go overboard. I'm not asking that we, and we can't, at peril of our soul, that we dismiss or neglect or downplay the horrific nature of the crime. What I am asking is that we have fresh attention. How much attention? I'm not sure. That we're open for discussion of this. But no attention is a mistake. there has to be room to recognize that in the camps, in the ghettos, even in the cattle cars taking people to their death, people put their arm around one another. We have to stay in touch with that, or we insult even the victims.
Tell me about some of the examples of that you did find in your travels.
The best example in five camps and maybe in several museums. I've been in Montreal, I've been in Paris, of course I've been to Yad Vashem in Israel, and I've been to the Holocaust Museum in this country. The best example is at Theresienstadt, the so-called model camp in Czechoslovakia, which the Nazis established to try and fool the world. It was a combination of a cruel fortress that where people were murdered, very small fortress, but then a large town adjacent to the fortress. And foreign visitors were permitted to come to the town, and their entire family stayed intact. And you would have the impression from your carefully monitored one-day walk-through visit that children played soccer, that families shopped in stores, that there was theater. You'd get an awesomely false impression. No one there could say otherwise. Okay? The truth is, it was a transit camp. Every day, the names were posted, and that afternoon, the trains were loaded. They went out one end of the train tracks off to the death camps. Another train pulled in with fresh people. My excitement in going twice now to that camp is to discover the best museum, the best memorial museum of any I've visited. And what made it best was that it paid attention to the fact that the teenage boys in that camp created a literary magazine. They published essays on the beauty of the dawn, on snow and what it meant to them, on their children's toys. The teenage boys knew they were doomed, knew any day their names would appear on the list. Hardly any of them involved in the magazine survived, but they published it. Their parents, the adults, ran a university which had over 500 instructors, and the instructors recorded 2,400 lectures, and the lectures were given at 5 a.m. in the morning all over the town. People got up at 4 and went to 5 a.m. non-credit classes to hear about the humanities, to hear about the sciences, knowing that later that day their name might show up on the transit list. To me, that's incredible. They did all this because of their resolve to stay the humans they knew they were. The Nazis could think anything they want about them. That was separate. That was the Nazis' problem. Their challenge, not problem, was to endlessly see in the mirror a full human being until their name came up, and then they would take the next step.
Did you see many tributes to people who helped people who were persecuted by the Nazis? People who reached out, hid others, saved others, helped others escape?
That part of the entire puzzle called the Holocaust, that part has gotten some wonderful, deserved attention. Yad Vashem, the Israeli Holocaust Museum, honors 22,000 righteous Gentiles. And there is the Avenue of the Righteous with a tree and a plaque for many of them. And more names are added all the time. In various cities, I've been in Munich, I've been in Berlin, I've been in Polish cities, you can find statues. You can find plaques in front of houses saluting people who hid Jews or who hid Unionists or who hid others who were hunted by the Nazis at great peril of their lives. So that has gotten the salute, never enough of a salute, but a salute that it deserves. My struggle is to get comparable attention, comparable honor paid to the victim inside the camp. the people who died in mass graves. I mean, I have testimony from a German officer who writes with surprise that he watches an old woman tickle under the chin an infant that she's holding in her arms so that the infant laughs with joy. The two of them at the edge of a pit about to be murdered with machine gun fire. The old woman knows this. An unknown number of people understood that as long as they had a breath to breathe, they were going to breathe it with dignity and care, care for themselves and care for others.
What's your hope for the field of the study of Holocaust history? What is your goal? What are you hoping will change?
My goal is to get more and more concerned people attentive to the demonstrated ability of victims in extremis, of victims in the most horrible of conditions, to resolve to remain the best people they can be. That's the recognition I'm hoping for. And that, I'm hoping, will lead to alteration in the educational plaques that are everywhere in the camps, in the display cases. We have display cases now of thousands of children's shoes, display cases of mounds of women's hair, display cases of hundreds of suitcases with the names of people on them. And those fill you with dread and maybe even outrage. I want to see a display case which memorializes mutual care, which shows, for example, in the movie Fateless, wonderful movie. In the movie Fateless, men lying in their bunks late at night watch with interest and even astonishment while four or five old men huddled under blankets light paraffin candles to mark the coming of the Sabbath. And it inspires the guys in the bunks. Now, what I want is all of us who are not direct experience of the Holocaust types, I want us to be inspired by the old men lighting the candles. I want us to take from it a boost to our confidence that we can get through, that our defeat is not written, it is not the sure thing, and that the bootjack types, the fascists, the terrorists, those who would frighten us into submission, that they're wrong, that we can come through.
Dr. Arthur Shostak is a professor emeritus at Drexel University. He spoke with our producer, Mike and Scott. Today, we're taking a different kind of look at the Holocaust. Coming up, we'll hear from a survivor who was hidden by a family in Poland who became a social worker when she arrived at this country. We'll also hear from a scholar who studies altruism and love. If you'd like to join our conversation, please call us 888-477-9499. Once again, that's 888-477-WHYY. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Penn supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit are providing evaluations to determine if you are suffering from depression. Symptoms may include mood swings, irritability, sleep disturbance, and lack of interest. Those who qualify may receive an initial examination and treatment with an investigational antidepressant for 3 to 12 months. For information, the DRU number at Penn is 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
On the next Fresh Air, writer-director Mike White. His films include Nacho Libre, The School of Rock, Orange County, and Chuck and Buck. His new film, Year of the Dog, stars Molly Shannon and Peter Sarsgaard. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're commemorating the Holocaust today by taking a different look at the experience. Joining me now are Kim Fendrick and Dr. Stephen Post. Kim Fendrick joins me here in the studio. She's a social worker in South Jersey. During the Holocaust, she, her family, and many others were hidden underneath a farmhouse of a Christian family in Poland. Dr. Stephen Post is a professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University. He's president of the Institute for Research on Unconditional Love, and along with Jill Niemark, he has co-authored his most recent work, which is Why Good Things Happen to Good People. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan.
And Stephen, welcome to the show.
Dan, it's a delight.
Kim, first, tell me your reaction to what you just heard from Professor Shostak.
It's about time. That's my reaction. I've always felt that the people who reached out and the people who reached out to each other have not been acknowledged.
Hmm. Stephen?
Oh, that is so true, not just to one another within the Jewish community, but remarkable individuals who reached out to a common humanity in that terrible circumstance.
Stephen, Shostak brings up a very important point, and he talks about the value of focusing on our humanity and nobility, in addition to acknowledging the Holocaust. But what does it say about our humanity, about being human, that we focus almost instinctively our time and energy on addressing the horrors?
Group conflict and group hatred is such a profoundly deep aspect of human experience. Love, a shared humanity, a sense of our oneness is at times such a very thin veneer. For some reason, we focus on that seething, boiling cauldron of hatred and violence, even when in those very circumstances there are so many redeeming moments that can really commemorate the goodness in our souls. Exactly why that is, I don't know that anybody can really give you a clear answer on it, Dan.
Well, I'll tell you one reason, and then I want to turn to you, Kim. One reason is, as I recall reading years ago, the book Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi.
Csikszentmihalyi,
yeah,
hard one. Yeah.
And he was right in the beginning of positive psychology,
yes.
You know, along with Martin Seligman here at Penn. And he said that this is the way we are hardwired, that we can go into a room that can look exquisite, perfect, and if there's a tile missing on the ceiling, that's where our eyes are going to go over and over again. That it's just the way the brain works. We've got a problem-solving brain, and the absence of anything else going on, we're going to look for problems to solve.
Now, all the positive psychologists are correct in pointing out how we have evolved to place an emphasis emotionally and responsively on the negative. Fear is such a powerful aspect of human nature. We tend to focus on fearful moments and fearful events and deficits. We tend to have a difficult time focusing on the more redeeming positive aspects of experience.
Well, speaking of fear, now, Kim, I want to turn to you. And the mantra that all Jews have, we shall never forget. And if we keep the horrors, the thinking is, I assume, if we keep the horrors in front of our faces, we will never forget, that there's a functional piece to seeing that over and over again.
Right, and that certainly has had its place after the Holocaust. It's absolutely, and there's so many Holocausts going on right now as well. We need to focus on that urgency and immediacy. But the subtext also is important to talk about, the how people survived, how people helped people survive, what made them help people survive, how we focused on the future. I say we, I was a child, but how the adults focused on the future, and regardless of whether there was a future or there was not.
Can we talk a little bit about your story? You were born in Poland.
In Poland, it is now the Ukraine, Eastern Poland.
Okay. And when did the Holocaust begin? How old were you?
I was 6 when the Nazis invaded our town.
And
I was 9 when we were liberated by the Russian army.
Okay. So tell us briefly what happened during those 3 years.
We ran and hid and were fortunate enough. First, we were in our apartment, which was surrounded by the ghetto wires. Then we were in the cellar or sub-cellar of our cell, of our basement. My father dug out a little space behind steps.
And who was in that sub-cellar?
My mother, my father, my grandmother, and I. We made our way into the forest when our food and water ran out because we didn't have running water. Water was obtained from the town well, and of course we couldn't go get any.
Did anybody help you get out of the ghetto?
Nobody helped us get out of the ghetto, but somebody helped us to stay safe. When we ran out of food and water, my parents stood me up. I was 7 years old, and told me that they were going to pin a note on my coat and send me out through the ghetto wires. They were just barbed wire rather than electrified barbed wire, as some other ghettos. And they were going to say on the note, please raise this child because we're going to take our own lives by laying down on train tracks. When I heard that at 7, it was incomprehensible to me how I could live without my parents. Death was not even on my radar. I had no idea what death was at 7, but I knew that I couldn't be without my parents. And I said to them, if you were going to give me away, why did you ever give birth to me? I don't know where that came from. I don't know how those words reached my lips. But they changed their minds. And my father, because we were in the first house of the ghetto, and the next house was outside of the ghetto, my father tunneled our way into the next house owned by a Ukrainian man who had a hardware store there, and we stayed there for many weeks.
And he risked his
life. He risked everything, and unfortunately he also risked everything by hiding Jews in his home, his family home, in another part of town. And he was betrayed, and he and his family were killed, as were all the Jews in his home. But when the store didn't open one day, that shade, that big shade, we didn't hear it go up. We knew that something terrible had happened, so we tunneled our way back into our cellar and then came out through the barbed wire because the ghetto was no longer patrolled.
And you were in the forest for
a while? We went into the forest, and then we came back into our house hoping to commit suicide with closing all the windows. And that didn't work because the windows had been bombed out. So we had to go back into the forest, and that's where my uncle, who was in hiding under the farm that you mentioned earlier, he came to the forest to find us, having sent someone else to look for us, a forest ranger who happened to have Christian papers, but he was Jewish. And he told my uncle where we were. My uncle came and took me first, then dug that hole that he was in bigger, and then brought my parents and my grandmother into that space and also some other people.
So your uncle dug this hole under the Christian farmhouse.
Yes, my uncle and another man.
How many people were under there?
Ultimately, there were 14 of us. The farmer and his wife agreed to 6 people, and ultimately there were 14 of us. The adults never expected more food than the farmer and his wife committed to for the 6. So I don't know whether there was or there wasn't, but that was our appreciation to him.
What do we know about this farmer, his wife, his family? Obviously, they risked their lives. What do we know?
Not only did they risk their lives, but they had 5 children, and they risked everyone's life.
Yes.
The 4 older children, 16 and up, left the farm eventually in fear of their lives, and who can blame them? The youngest one, the 13-year-old, was not told about our existence under the barn. They were religious people.
Did we ever find out, did you ever find out why he did it?
I have never found that out, but his oldest grandson came to this country in, I met him in 91. He had become my third child, and he believed, he says that they never talked about it, but he believed they did it because it was the right thing to do. The farmer was the overseer in a labor camp where my uncle was a laborer. My uncle was a craftsman, so he helped the farmer, and they became friends, and that's how the connection happened.
The story develops further in this country. I want to get to that in a minute, but tell me about what happened underneath the farmhouse. How long were you there?
I was there for 10 months.
All right. Now, you have said to me that those were the best times for you, the safest.
Absolutely. We were safe from the elements. We had food, and as safe from the Nazis as we could be, because we were not in the open.
Tell me about the relationships among those people. There had to be some politics, some leadership struggles, some... How did that work?
There are many stories. There were very few arguments. One of the issues that came up for my mother, she was sort of morally in charge of a 15-year-old girl from another family whose parents were still in the forest, and a 19-year-old boy came into that cave, and they struck up more than a friendship. And my mother said to this young woman, "You may not sleep next to this young man," because the greatest fear was pregnancy.
Mm.
But guess who got that honor? 8-year-old little me. And I was too wise for an 8-year-old, and I said, "Okay, I'll sleep next to him, but you have to put a 2x4 between us," as if he might be interested in an 8-year-old.
So who was in charge down there? And who took care of you, and how?
I don't recall a pecking order of who was in charge. Everyone, well, I guess the person who had the moral charge was my uncle's mother, who was the oldest person there. And she was given the privilege, such as it was, to divide the food equally among all the people there. That was the biggest issue that we had, the food.
And there was no arguing?
There was no arguing. I remember my mother sharing her portion in half and giving her half of her portion to my father's full portion because his hunger was so much greater than hers.
And I wonder if that happened between other people
it
down
may
there,
have.
Those
I
who were hungry or got more.
Yeah, I can't speak to that, but the biggest issue was that Mrs. Silber, my uncle's mother, be fair and equal and just. So my father fashioned a little cutter for bread, for potatoes, and made some kind of ladle out of, I can't imagine out of what, but he did, and each portion was equal.
Now, you felt safe under there, but the adults certainly didn't. They knew they weren't safe in the long run.
The danger, as I felt it, and as we talked about it later, one of the reasons they didn't feel safe is that the farmer liked his drink, and he would go to the local inn every Saturday night.
Mm.
And it just scared them so much that he might say something. Another moment when we felt absolutely we were going to be found out was when their 13-year-old was playing with a friend in the yard. Now, he didn't know that we were there. And our outlet into the air was a little hole like a softball. And the ball he was playing with fell into the hole. And his face followed. Fortunately, he covered the light with his head as he reached for the ball.
Huh.
So he didn't see us.
So your family, the adults there, weren't confident that they would survive, and still your mother insisted
that I practice my multiplication tables and all the capitals of Europe. They would drill me on that. When we were in the ghetto, she drilled me on reading and writing, which was, I didn't like it, but she insisted that if we live, I will know how to read and write. If we die, I will have been kept busy.
You know, Stephen, one of the themes I hear over and over again is we take care of the future. It's about the kids. It's about a future we may or may not ever see, but we still have to take care of it. That's the theme I hear repeating as Kim tells her story.
Very much so. It might come under the category of generativity, of passing the torch of decency and civility to future generations. That is such a hardwired aspect of human nature across cultures. And the fact that that remains alive and vibrant in this very, very difficult circumstance is really a tribute to the better side of what it is to be human.
One of the things I complain about in today's culture is this generativity, this instinct to take care of our kids and their future, I think is a bit misguided in today's culture, because we are working so hard to protect our children from all adversity and to make sure they have the best of everything, that a lot of this is backfiring. But, you know, in our hearts, we're doing what we've done for ever since we were a species, and that's taking care of our kids. You say we're hardwired to help one another, and so does Shostak, says the same thing. You said when we spoke to you before the show that although we assume all Germans became Nazis, studies show that's not true.
That's exactly right. There were many Germans who resisted the fanaticism and the hatred and the violence. And indeed, there were so many who did play the role of rescuers. The cynics tell us that, in fact, whenever we help anyone, we're really interested in ourselves. We're counting for some reciprocal gain. We're waiting for a little bit of a tit for tat, or maybe we're just wanting to enhance our reputations. But the great story of the Holocaust rescuers is that, in fact, had they been found out, they would have been killed. And so they had no reason whatsoever to let other people know what they were doing. There was no reciprocal gain here. They were doing this, just as was stated, because of our sense of a shared humanity, of common decency, of it being the right thing to do. They weren't worrying about payoff or payback. They were doing the right thing, and they did it even in circumstances where their own biological families would be annihilated were they found out.
What do we know about those who did versus those who didn't?
Well, this is a topic that has been studied by a number of people, principally Sam and Pearl Oliner. Sam himself was rescued by a Christian family during the Holocaust. His biological family was essentially annihilated. He went back years later as a social scientist and interviewed many of the rescuers. And what he found out was interesting. First of all, very typically, the rescuers had parents who were generative, parents who taught those rescuers as children respect for humanity, parents who invoked the golden rule. That was an interesting theme in Oliner's studies. And so these rescuers were ones who somehow were able to stand up against the powerful pressures of Nazi hatred and group prejudice in the name of oneness, of a sense of a shared humanity, and that moral fiber was very deeply a part of their lives.
Boy, doesn't that say everything? We're talking about the Holocaust today. We're taking a different look at it. We're looking at the humanity, the kindness that takes place in the face of all of the horrors that were happening over there. My guests are Kim Fendrick and Stephen Post. Stephen Post is a professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University. His most recent book is co-authored with Jill Niemark. It's called Why Good Things Happen to Good People. Kim Fendrick is a social worker in South Jersey. During the Holocaust, she was hidden underneath the farmhouse of a Christian family in Poland. Well, to join our conversation, number is 888-477-9499. We'll get to your calls right after a break. Again, that's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're taking a look at stories of humanity underneath the horrors. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Of the University of Pennsylvania Medical Center supports WHYY. Penn's DRU is conducting research into alternative herbal treatments of anxiety. Symptoms may include nervousness, tension, sleep problems, and concentration difficulty. Those who qualify will receive an initial evaluation and may take part in a research study with chamomile or black cohosh for up to 3 months. For details, 215-662-3462.
Next time on Day to Day.
Our top story. There are no top stories because every story is tops to us.
If people are talking about it, it's news to him.
Amazing. Shocking. Who knew?
Brian Unger brings it to you first.
We have this late breaking news. The news is not broken, nor is it late.
It's the Unger Report.
Are you in or what?
Mondays on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're with Stephen Post, who's president of the Institute on Research on Unconditional Love. Kim Fendrick is a social worker. And during the Holocaust, she, her family, and many others were hidden under a farmhouse in Poland. We're taking a new look at the Holocaust, the human side, what we've done to help one another rather than harm one another. Kim, Stephen, and Professor Shostak say we are hardwired to help one another. One who's been through the Holocaust, you've seen the best and the worst of humanity. Do you believe that? That we're hardwired? That it's our instinct to help?
I don't know, but I will share this comment with you that came to my attention in 1991 when a Dutch-born psychiatrist, who herself was a rescuer in Holland at age 18, she said she had studied the subject of why people helped, and she said that people who helped had never been physically abused by their parents. And that just really stuck with me.
Well, that's certainly has to be one of the factors. And, you know, Stephen, you contributed thoughts about the others.
Right.
But you've seen the best and the worst. I wonder how you emerge, certainly as a young woman when you got to this country, how would you have answered the question, what does it mean to be human? How would you have answered that as a 15-year-old, 20-year-old?
I think my models would have been my parents. And what they did in trying to survive after they didn't want to die by the Nazis' hand, for me, they knew I didn't want to be without them. They wanted to survive, and they cherished every day of my life when they were with me. And I don't know that at 15 I even thought about the bigger picture. It was so hard to just making my way in this country and in life in general. But I think my models would have been my parents and my grandmother.
Why did you become a social worker? Don't tell me tuition was cheap.
No, I won't. I know why I became a therapist. Because when I was that young, and in hiding, and I was mainly with all adults, the adults seemed to consider my opinions as worthwhile. They would talk to me about issues, and my comments seem to resonate with them, to use one of your favorite words. And it was such a powerful feeling that as I was growing up, I knew that I wanted to deal with the human experience.
What powerful lessons you're teaching adults about how to parent and what impact it has on children. Let's go to the phones. We've got Israel on the line. Israel, hi, you're on Voices.
Hi, hello, Dr. Gottlieb. I think your show is remarkable, and I'm so pleased that you're touching upon this subject of living and loving in the present, even in the darkest of circumstances.
Thank you.
I don't know, you know, I'm considered generally to be among a few people, to be among the youngest of the Holocaust survivors. I was actually in utero. My mother was 2 months pregnant with me. They were living in Holland. And the reason I called, and my father and mother got out of Holland. They left from Rotterdam, and their boat was attacked from the French Nazi forces in May of 1940. And they managed to save my three sisters, Shirley, Ruthie, and Selma, who were 4, 8, and 12. The reason I'm calling is because on my father's side, he had 11 brothers and sisters, only three of whom survived. They all perished, and their families perished in the camps. I was just calling to share with you that I had an aunt, Fagel, and she was 17 years old and was in the death camps, was in three of them. They had daily selections where females were on one side, males on the other, and they'd be selected for their health, or their work abilities. The ones who were deemed inappropriate for work were killed immediately. And while she was in the line, a young man who was also in the line, she and he, their eyes caught. And in the line, they sort of pantomimed a hello, and they apparently became smitten with one another. They were both saved that day, and they gradually were able to make a little bit of contact in the camp, and they found a rabbi who was dying of tuberculosis, and they managed to get the rabbi to marry them. And they were able to be in this situation, although separated, for just a matter of a few weeks. When they both perished in the camp, I found out from my Aunt Dora, who was liberated from one of the camps and knew about it. I just wanted to share that with you, not because of the terrible tragedy of their having died and perished in the camp, which is something we all need to remember, all of the victims, the leftist and anarchist and communist people who were killed in the camps, the gay people, the homosexual people, the gypsies, anyone who was mentally or physically deemed defective. I mean, there were so many people that died, Russians.
Israel, I have to tell you, after hearing the story of your aunt in the camps, you have done to me what few people have been able to do. You've left me at a loss for words. And I thank you.
Yes, I would just say that I wrote a brief sonnet for them, which will be in a Northwestern University Press. I know there's no time. I mean, it's just right. A few lines. Maybe I could just read it briefly. It's called Love in a Death Camp.
You know what you could do?
Yes,
you
send
could
it to
send
you.
It. We'll put it on the webpage.
Lovely, I will.
And I'll certainly put it on mine. Thank you so much.
It's a great reaffirmation that people, even in the darkest of circumstances, choose to live and to love and to express their humanity. I know that so little of that is even talked about.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your call. Israel's story. The story reminds me very much of. The very well-known Holocaust survivor, Gerda Weissman Klein, who was in a labor camp, and the army soldier who liberated her was also a Jew who had gotten out early, and they both fell in love at that moment and lived blissfully, fortunately, for many, many years. There's lots of stories of love. Stephen, it sounds like love is probably the last thing that goes when it comes to being human.
When I think about
the Holocaust really is a metaphor for the dark side of life, somewhat along the lines of Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning. It seems to me that so often, for a whole variety of reasons, in our families, in our nations, we find these dark times, and yet always love is the only option. It's only love that can defeat hatred. And to the extent that we have confidence in that notion, to the extent that our parents and our non-parent mentors have instilled confidence in the power of love within our hearts, that ultimately is the only hope, the only passion for the possible. There really is nothing else.
Kim, isn't compassion, though, and altruism higher up on the developmental scale? I mean, don't we need to feel safe and secure first so that, given the option, we're going to pursue security first?
I would think so, but security is such a relative word. We can feel secure within ourselves, and we can feel secure in our environment. My uncle was not secure when he came to rescue us. In his environment, he was in hiding, but certainly that wasn't security. But he was a man who knew what he stood for, and he needed to do this to save our lives.
Stephen, I guess one of the things I wonder is something you've said. You've said we are lambs, we are not sheep. I mean, we are sheep, we're not wolves.
Not wolves.
That we tend to follow in the pursuit of security.
Yes. So, Dan, when in the early 1960s, research was done in the United States by a number of individuals, but most renowned was Stanley Milgram, a social psychologist at Yale University. He would take subjects into his laboratory, and there he would stand lording it over them with his long white laboratory jacket, a real authority figure. In the meanwhile, he had paid actors to sit behind a glass window. Every time he would read a set of words to the actors and they didn't repeat them back perfectly, he would instruct the research subjects, who had no idea that these actors were just actors, to inflict a voltage by flipping a switch, and the actors would scream out at higher and higher volumes as the voltage was lifted higher and higher itself. And so in the end, a third of the subjects voted with their feet. They said, "Dr. Milgram, we refuse to have anything to do with this. It's utterly inhumane. It makes a mockery of our souls." And they walked out despite his authority.
So what's your take on the other two-thirds?
Well, the other two-thirds were not wolves, Dan, but they were sheep. In other words, what happened there, and it's such a classic problem in human history, we have these deeply innate tendencies toward empathy and compassion and generosity, but those compassionate virtues can be overwhelmed and overcome by what scientists call hierarchical virtues, the virtues that make us want to please our superiors, that want us to function well in demanding hierarchical systems. And so an awful lot of human evil is not so much that we are purposeful wolves, but that we are sheep when it comes to these negative hierarchies.
And in the pursuit of security. In the couple minutes we have left, Kim, I'd like you to tell briefly what happened when you got to this country and you got a call that a man named Walter was coming over here. Walter was the grandson of the farmer who saved your family.
Right. My aunt called me from California and told me that he had arrived here. I assumed he was going back. She said no, he was staying, and I met him. And I was very fortunate that I could, in some small way, pay back is not even a good concept. I could do something for him and his wife and make their lives possible in this country, and I was so grateful for that.
He became like your son.
He did.
Didn't he?
And yes, he did.
You became like his mother. It was a beautiful relationship to watch. But what struck me, Kim, is I knew this man who unfortunately recently passed away. But because of what his family did, not even what he did, because of what his family did, I loved him. And I loved, still love, his wife. And the compassion is contagious all throughout our community. So many people reached out to help him just because the compassion is contagious. And Stephen, I know you hear that over and over again, how contagious compassion is.
Well, indeed it is. And compassion is something that is transmitted. That's a sub-theme that's come through in this wonderful hour of conversation. It's not taught through a lecture. Even the latest science of the brain and the helper's high, right, and how good we feel when we have the warm glow of helping others in an unselfish way, all of that's very real. But the bottom line is that there's no substitute for passing the torch from one person to another by setting an example, whether it's parents or non-parents, whoever it might be in our lives. And we also all have a sacred obligation.
And with that beautiful thought, we're going to have to say goodbye. Stephen, it was great being with you again. Kim, thank you so much for joining us and telling us your story.
You're welcome.
Stephen Post is a professor of bioethics at Case Western Reserve University. He's president of the Institute on Research on Unconditional Love. And he's written, along with Jill Niemark, Why Good Things Happen to Good People. Kim Fendrick is a social worker in South Jersey and a hidden child from the Holocaust. Earlier on, we heard from Dr. Arthur Shostak, who's a sociologist, author, and retired professor. Philadelphia's annual memorial ceremony for victims of the Holocaust. The event will be held on Yom HaShoah, Sunday, April 25th at 1 o'clock at 16th and Ben Franklin Parkway. On Wednesday, April 11th, The Variety Club will present a free panel discussion on the topic of autism throughout the life cycle. I'll be the host, and we'll have several guests on the show. Well, if you've got want to reach us, our email address is voices@whyy.org. The engineer for today's show has been Julian Hertzfeld. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends. Data.